This is the Blaze Radio on demand.
Readers.com is your one-stop shop for quality reading glasses with over 700 styles under $20. Readers.com offers bifocal readers, reading sunglasses, computer readers, and more with powers from 1.0 to 6.0. With free shipping on orders over $30, friendly customer service, and easy returns, you are sure to find your perfect pair. Enter the coupon code BUCK at checkout for 30% off your next order. That's Readers.com. Happy eyes, happy wallet.
Now, spreading freedom across the nation, this is 3, 2, 1.
The Buck Sexton Show.
Team Buck, welcome to the Freedom Hut. I bring news. News of the election. I know it's a heartbreak for all of you. I get it. I understand. I don't know how we're going to move past it. I don't know how we're going to deal with it. But John Kasich is, in fact, dropping out of the Republican presidential primary. I know. Just breaking now. You're just seeing it on the news feeds as I come on air. Kasich's candidacy is no more. Oh, the humanity. This guy. Oh, man. Karate Chop, what's up? What's up, my friend? No? Not going to do it anymore. Not going to make it happen. Kasich, not going to do it. Not prudent. He's dropping out. I loved it. You know, last night, I was on CNN for a couple of hours, super late. It was, we could say, to be charitable, a feisty panel. My voice was already a little scratchy, and I was being... It's one thing to be shouted down when you actually can sort of shout back, but it's another thing when you're kind of like, hold on a second! But there was a little bit of that. Whatever, you get used to it after a while. I call it, whenever you're in that situation, call it the hyena arena. You know, you just better get ready, better get loud, battling it out with the hyenas. So, all right. That's just in cable news in general. So, where was I? Oh, yeah, Kasich is out. I know, you're super bummed. Many of you, there'll be gnashing of teeth. There will be a lot of sadness among you because, yeah, granted, he was still technically losing to Marco Rubio, who dropped out of the race many weeks ago. So he was losing to somebody who was no longer a candidate. Never mind also obviously losing to Ted Cruz, who as of last night is no longer a candidate. And we'll get more serious about that and talk about that together in just a moment here. But I just think it's fitting. I'm kind of psyched that I get to break the news to all of you that Karate Chop Kasich has broken his last pile of bricks for the presidential primary this year. Hi-ya! You remember karate in the 80s? Like, I remember I took like a couple of karate classes when I was a tiny kid. My parents said I was terrible at it, was falling asleep the whole time. It wasn't until later on when I actually got a little more interested in that sort of thing. But yeah, it was... Everyone was walking and wearing a gi, and you know, all these little kids with all these different colored belts. You know, are you a yellow belt? Are you a green belt? No, I'm a neon purple belt because that's like when you're super ninja. I don't know. There are all these different belts. They're color coded by your awesomeness. Wouldn't that be fun if you walked around in real life? It's like, what's up, man? Oh, I see. You're wearing a beige belt. Mine's yellow. Son, what's up? So anyway, or you know, red was like really, if you had a red belt, I think red was just shy of black. Black belt was obviously the best belt, except for maybe gold belt. I don't know. I can't remember now. There are all these different belts, karate stuff. But yeah, Karate Chop Kasich is dropping out of the race. It was kind of funny. I was on the panel last night. I kept saying, you know, Ted Cruz, because now in some of the campaign postmortems, which are going to, you're going to hear a lot of that stuff. You have people saying, you know, Ted Cruz, you know, he was never going to win. It was ridiculous. And I'm like, all right, everybody, there were 17 candidates and he was the second to last man standing. And it was considered a very clever quip for people to say, no, John Kasich is still. Yeah. I mean, and I'm sure there's also, you know, some members of parties that are on the ballot in like two states or something. So that doesn't count. Right. John Kasich was hanging in there. I don't know why. I think legitimately because he just wanted to be in the news cycle a little longer. Which makes me think, I know people say this will never happen. I think he could still be Trump's VP. I think he could still be Trump's VP. There were some jokes made offset by some people last night that maybe Kasich should name, while he's still in, he should name Carly Fiorina VP because she could set another record for the shortest vice presidential candidate tenure ever, as well as the shortest double vice presidential candidate tenure ever. But I like Carly. I actually think that she didn't have a really fair situation to her that she was in for such a short period of time. Anyway, Kasich is out, which you will see no tears shed by me over that one. And it was just weird. I tweeted this out last night. I was like, Kasich was the guy at the bar. All the lights are on. All the patrons have gone home. The bartender is sweeping up. And he somehow still thinks that, you know, he's going to get a little lucky. No, that's not going to happen. And now he has recognized reality and has stepped out. So we probably won't have to talk about John Kasich that much more, unless he does become a vice presidential candidate. But even then, as we all know, VPs are kind of eh. But all right, now let's transition into the Ted Cruz situation. Here's what I'll say about all this. I wrote something on CNN about this as well. You can check it out on CNN.com. Here's my sense of it. And it was about what does never Trump really mean now in terms of the numbers, right? I do not need, if I may just put this out there, every person who is going to be never Trump always and forever to tell me that. Okay, great. I get it. I'm not saying that's not the case for a lot of people. I have no idea what the numbers are. And a lot of people in media who say they're never Trump, I believe most, if not all of them, will be true to their word. I don't think all of them will be, to be honest with you, but I think a lot of them will be in the media. But I don't need people to tell me, well, I'm never Trump. Okay, I get it, right? There will be people who are never Trump. But from the perspective of what does this mean for the election, it really matters how many never Trumpers there are. Not how many never Trumpers there are today, how many never Trumpers there will be in November. And I've been thinking about this, right, because we have a lot of time. I sort of liken the whole situation with Trump winning Indiana by a lot. I mean, he crushed the competition. It was a landslide. It was huge. I wasn't expecting that, but I don't think very few people were thinking that it was going to go down like that. And I certainly didn't think that Ted Cruz was going to drop out. And I know for a lot of you, it's deeply disappointing. I'm disappointed, but this is what I would say about where we go from here. First off, my little fun analogy, because I already made a closing bar analogy. Closing time. Hat tip Jonah Goldberg for the what's the name of that band that does Closing Time, the song? It's not Chumbawamba. That's I Get Knocked Down and I'll Get Up Again. But Closing Time was, I don't know, whatever. They were like a one-hit wonder in the early 2000s. And it would always come on super late at a bar. And you're just like, yeah, I don't know who wants to take me home or whatever. Anyway, that's right. Rocking out the tunes here today in the Freedom Hut. That's really the early 2000s, man. Music-wise, I think we overlook it, you know? Yes, I'm really a child of the 90s. But the early 2000s had some good stuff, too. Is it Andre 3000 or Andre 5000? I forget now. But anyway. 3000. Thank you, John. I knew that, obviously. I was just testing John on the board to make sure he got that right. They had some great stuff in the early 2000s. The Love Below was a great album. I think that was what it was called. All right. So back to where we are and all. Oh, yeah. I said that it was sort of like we had to have the breakup talk. The Ted Cruz supporters, we had to have a breakup talk. We thought it would be at the end of the summer, but instead it happened Memorial Day weekend. Meaning that I think a lot of us had already realized that at the convention there was at least a chance that this would happen. I was not maybe in June after the California primary, I was not prepared for this at all. I didn't foresee this at all. And that's perfect, right? Because this whole primary cycle, there's no such thing as a conventional wisdom. Because the old political realities are no longer true. It's kind of like when I talked to you a bit about the Middle East. Our old structural alliances, our sense of how we create stability, who we have to work with, who our allies are, who our enemies are, that has all dramatically changed and is still changing. It's in constant flux. So if you apply a sort of Kissingerian approach of the old realpolitik of supporting dictators and keeping the oil flowing and supporting Israel, that's not the same now. That's not enough now just to think of it in those terms. And in this election, it's been sort of similar. It's constant change, constant flux. And with nobody really recognizing, I think, or being able to recognize in advance what the future will be. I always tell you this, by the way. Nobody can predict the future. Always remember that. Nobody can predict the future. The greatest statisticians, the greatest prognosticators, the greatest gypsy Roma, pardon me, with the crystal ball, doesn't matter. They cannot predict the future. So I didn't think we would have to have this talk about Ted Cruz so early. And I wanted to take, we're going to talk a little more politics today, but I got other stuff to talk to you about today as well. I've got some Obamacare, national security. The great thing about the Freedom Hut is it's everything that's going on that I think we should talk about, and whatever that may be. You know, I don't sit here all day just talking about how much the leadership in D.C. stinks and how much I love the Constitution. And, oh, by the way, do you realize how much the leadership in D.C. stinks? And let's talk about how the Democratic leadership is awful. And I love the Constitution. And, you know, that's just not – I don't find that – I mean, I listen to talk radio. I'm a consumer of talk radio. I have been a long time. I just don't find that interesting. I can be a sort of fun avatar for anger, I suppose, or not – is avatar? That's not really the right word. Outlet for anger. There you go. But it's not a good usage of our time. What I'll tell you about where I stand. Semisonic. Thank you. Semisonic is the name of the band. Closing Time. Yeah. Yeah. I sing about as well as right now as Jeremy Jam from Parks and Rec. One of the best lesser characters on that show. If you haven't seen Parks and Rec, I kind of need you to check out a few episodes. You could start in season like 2 or 3 when it starts getting really good. The first season's not great. Then you'll catch more random references I make in the show because Jeremy Jam is awesome. You got jammed. Where were we? Yeah, Ted Cruz. This is not to cast aside the seriousness of anything that's happened in the last 24 hours, by the way. I will say this to you now, and I kind of make this promise to you, but also ask this in return. It's going to be a long election cycle now. And we're going to have to be able to talk about things and share ideas and have some fun with it, too. So when I make a joke about, I mean, everyone, you know, you can make a joke about Kasich. And until yesterday, apparently, by the way, I mean, you know, all due respect, my man Joe. I did not know he was a Kasich supporter. That came out of left field. I was like, whoa, Kasich supporter. Who knew? But otherwise, I can usually make fun of Kasich and get away with it. But, you know, I'll make jokes about Trump. I'll make jokes about Hillary. We'll make jokes about the whole situation. That doesn't mean that it's time to write out an 800-word lecture about the seriousness of the threat to our republic. And I get all of that, too. I really do. And I'm trying to sort of push us in a direction now. Those of you who join me here every day or join me on the podcast, whenever it is, at night or the next day or next week, we're going to have fun conversations, in-depth conversations. We're going to continue to follow this election. I'm not going to do a lot of advocacy. I'm not going to sit here and try to convince you to either be never Trump or not be never Trump or be, you know, we're just going to talk about it together because I don't have the answers on this one. I really don't. And I think that that's the first place where we should start together on this. I don't pretend to know what is right now best for all of us. If you are somebody who believes in limited government, we'll talk about, by the way, what all this means. I mean, I want to have very frank and open conversations with you about, you know, why we think about recent presidential candidates. I mean, for example, how conservative really was George W. Bush, if we go back and look at it? And were we thinking, or were we just so wrapped up in the war on terror that we didn't realize that he was kind of a populist, centrist, some would even call him on certain issues a bit of a rhino. Nice guy, good guy, well-intentioned, but not really very conservative, actually. So we've been there before. I mean, there's a lot of ways we can talk about all this without it becoming a big fight between never Trump and all the rest. I'm just not interested in that. It's not worth our time. We have a lot of other stuff to talk about, for one. We've got a lot of time to pass between now and even the convention, right? And so Hillary and Bernie are still technically fighting it out. Technically, I mean, you know, Bernie's all like, don't count me out. You know what I'm going to do? I can come out of nowhere. You know, the millionaires and the billionaires, they're trying to write these checks for Hillary. Yeah, they are. And she's going to win. But I admire Bernie's spunk. But so this is kind of my way of saying, and I know I'm rambling a bit about this, but I'm a radio host. So rambling is sort of what I'm paid to do. It's disappointing that Ted Cruz lost. It's disappointing that he's out at this point in time. And I don't have all the answers, but I have a lot of thoughts on this, and I'm going to be following everything, including the political side of things, closely. And we're going to have fun, and we're going to talk about it, and all ideas will be welcome, and we're going to see where it goes. And we're going to take a deep breath, and if it means in the end, or if it means at some point, we really get closer and closer, and more of Team Buck, you know, is really supporting a third party, or if they decide that some of them are going Trump, whatever, that's all fine. But that's how we're going to approach it here. We're just going to have a continuing Freedom Hut chat about everything going on, politics and otherwise. All are welcome. Trump supporters, Trump haters, never Trump, always Trump, maybe Trump, whatever. I'll speak to you honestly about it. And I start from the proposition that I have ideas, I have thoughts, I have information to share, I have analysis that I think is worth your time. But I don't have all the answers on this one. Maybe together we can find more. Sponsor this half hour is Silencer Shop, my friends. There's been a lot of noise about the changes coming to the silencer industry because of the new 41F regulation. Beginning July 13th, 2016, 41F will require silencer transfer applications to include FBI fingerprints, passport photos, and much more. But Silencer Shop has your back with its Powered by Silencer Shop guarantee. Silencer Shop promises to process your transfer application successfully, or they'll give you $100. That is the Powered by Silencer Shop guarantee. Just purchase an in-stock silencer and tax stamp between May 1st and July 6th using the Powered by Silencer Shop Buy It Local program. All transfer information must be submitted to Silencer Shop before July 8th. Get peace of mind to know how your application is done before 41F and done correctly. Other restrictions may apply. Found out everything you need to know about the new 41F regulation and the Powered by Silencer Shop guarantee at silencershop.com. Again, that is silencershop.com. Back after the break.
This is the Buck Sexton Show.
The Blaze Radio Network.
The founder of this company 10 years ago was trying to sell his house. He's kind of an important guy. And he said to his wife, if this is what it's like for us, how do people who have no clout ever get around this? So he started a company and it went into business, I think 3 years ago. Their deal is their word is their bond. And they are people that listen to this show. They are just like you. Now, how can I say that? Because I'm the founder of the company. RealEstateAgentsITrust.com.
All right, team, the phone lines are open. As you know, the Freedom Hut has phone lines open now 3 hours a day because we don't have to videotape things because we don't do that anymore. It's pure radio. Hey, easy listening in the Freedom Hut. Pure radio. We can take some calls. That's the good part. 888-900-3393. My voice is like 80% back. It's really nice. I missed you, voice. I missed you. Let's take Dr. Lee in Texas. What's up, Dr. Lee?
Hey, Buck, thanks for taking my call. I'm glad to hear
your voice
better.
Thank you.
Yeah. So I just wanted to talk about another possible contingency plan for the election coming up. I had a veteran colleague that does a lot of work on the Hill with the lobbyists and several of the senators in a scientific endeavors. And he mentioned to me a couple of weeks ago after he got back from his recent trip that all of his colleagues up there, most of whom are liberally minded, I would say, are all telling him that they are positive that Hillary will be indicted and that currently they're slow rolling it so that she can become the nominee. And then when she does, they're going to indict her and then they're going to replace her with Joe Biden. I know this sounds super far-fetched, but this is coming to me from legit sources, and I tend to believe
these are government sources. Like, what can you tell me? Because I mean, I just don't buy it.
Yeah. So these are both mostly lobbyists on the Hill, K Street lobbyists.
Dr. Lee, I'm telling you, and I will. I was going to say I will eat a glutinous bagel, but that actually might send me to the ER, so I can't do that. I don't have a hat because I don't fit my head, so I can't eat that either. A crow? Maybe I can eat crow. That's gluten-free. There's just no way. There's no way they're going to indict Hillary. I'm not saying that your sources aren't smart people and that this it's just not going to happen. You would have to have – think about what that would entail. You would have to have Loretta Lynch, the Attorney General of the United States under Barack Obama's administration, allowing charges to proceed. It is in her full discretion not to bring charges. Why would she bring charges?
No, I know. I understand my dog's on the floor as well, and so is his. And he confirmed it to me from his sources. So,
well, Dr. Lee, if you are right, I will give you full credit. I will give you full credit on this one because that's a bold prediction. Dr. Lee, always good to have you on. Team, we got a lot more coming. Stay with me.
This is the Buck Sexton Show.
The Blaze Radio Network.
Sexton Show.
All right, team, 888-900-3393. The lines are open. Would love to chat with you. First, we have a guest today. First time, Emily Jasinski. She is a program officer at the Young Americas Foundation, program officer for PR. Emily, thank you so much for calling in.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So what are your thoughts? Quite a night in politics last night. I leave the rest for now to you. What do you think?
Well, you know, I can't say that it wasn't predictable. Over the past week, I think the picture was really starting to crystallize of exactly where we would be come convention.
Wait, you thought Cruz was going to drop? I mean, I know Indiana maybe was going to go for Trump, but you thought Cruz might drop?
I didn't predict Cruz dropping, but I did predict the race crystallizing and knowing where we would stand in terms of not having a brokered convention, because that had been the hot topic about a month ago. We were all thinking we're headed to a brokered convention. I think over the course of the past week, it became pretty clear that that wasn't going to happen. I am surprised that Cruz dropped, more surprised that Kasich dropped, because John Kasich had really been hedging his bets, saying something's going to happen, Trump's going to drop out, whatever's going to happen, I'm going to be the last man standing. So I am surprised he dropped out, because I think his entire strategy was hedging his bets that come convention time, something happens to Trump, he's the last man standing. So I'm surprised by that as well.
Yeah, the narrative had been, and I know because this was over at CNN, this is something we had to talk about a fair amount. It had been there was going to be this crazy convention, and everyone's doing all this deep dive into the legality of what you can do with delegates. And I felt like journalists I knew were stockpiling gas masks and riot shields for it. I mean, it was just supposed to be pandemonium down in Cleveland. And nope, it's going to be a Trump coronation now. That much is clear. John Kasich, I don't know, you probably just saw the news, Emily. John Kasich dropped out. So the Kasich squad has lost their man. But now the whole conversation in the GOP, well, part of the conversation, I should say, in the GOP turns towards, I would think, unity. How do you think that's going to go? What are the prospects for a unified GOP behind a Trump candidacy?
Yeah, so that's why I think the dropouts are particularly interesting, and I wonder what's coming from the RNC, because the idea of having this broker convention, like what you were talking about, the gas masks and the riot gear, in terms of party unity, I mean, wow, can you imagine what that would have looked like in July? So I think that these dropouts kind of are signaling something to me might be coming from the RNC, might be coming from party leaders. So I actually think whether that increases the prospects for unity or not, all I can say is that as someone who considers himself a movement conservative, right now I'm actually pretty terrified about the prospect of party unity, because we're so splintered, and it's not splintered in multiple factions, it's splintered in two. You know what I mean? It's
yeah, pro and anti-Trump.
Exactly.
Yeah, this is a GOP civil war with two sides, really. There isn't much of a third right now. That could change. I will say, though, and I'm repeating a point that I made on TV last night, so, you know, I'm going for it again. But I do think that the fact that the other campaigns have dropped out now, I think it's better, and this you can never prove whether I'm right or not, which is my favorite kind of analysis, Emily, because, you know, it's just my opinion, man. You can never prove this or not, but I think that the dropping out of Cruz and Kasich at this stage is better than the tear gas and OMG, what's going on? This is a total, you know, this is a total WrestleMania, complete catastrophe coming up in Ohio where the convention was going to be. I think it's better that we start the conversation now and people can at least have some time for this to settle in, because if Cruz came out of the convention after being hundreds of delegates behind, the Trump supporters were going to freak out. If Trump came out the winner and people felt like he had done wheeling and dealing and, you know, Cruz was pushed out, then the Cruz conservatives would have walked. That still could happen, and I'm with you that it's not looking so great right now, but I feel like at least there's, now this is going to sound like I'm doing a Dr. Phil, I feel like there's more time to heal.
No, that's great. I actually completely agree with you on that, because personally, when you look at it, it's the idea of what that convention would have looked like. I feel like on the right now, what we're craving more than anything, because this past year has been such a mess, is some stability and some confirmation that things can return to normal order. And so I thought that Senator Cruz's decision was actually really classy. It was like a very classy move to say, I'm going to have respect for the process and for the party and for the way that things have all played out, and do the right thing here. So I thought it was totally classy, and I think that it speaks to, you know, our ability to kind of organize as a movement moving forward, is that we can sort of get back to some level of stability. So I was
I have to say, earlier on, I think back in maybe in October even, I think I was writing about how I thought there were candidates that really needed to get out of the way and there needed to be consolidation earlier. And, you know, what you see is that the more serious candidates, and granted it's further on in the race and more money has been spent and there's greater clarity as to where it's all going, but you had a bunch of candidates hanging in there, you know, that were just, I mean, Pataki was just not facing reality. And you can say, oh, well, it doesn't matter. But, you know, on the debate stages, and there was some degree of, you know, media coverage that these guys got. I mean, the candidates who just never had a shot, the candidates who were at 0 to 3% the whole time, or 0 to 5% national support the whole time, I think they stayed in it too long, and I think it changed the trajectory of the race. Now, again, nobody can prove me wrong, so I love these bits of analysis I could throw out there. I want to ask you this, though. Where do you think this stands? Because, of course, now there's a... Well, actually, wait, before I go into the Democrat-Republican side of things... I had a panel last night on CNN where there were a couple of Democrats, and I mean they were really throwing down over whether Bernie Sanders is still a viable candidate or not. I'm just sitting here, I was kind of laughing. I'm like, guys, it's going to be Hillary Clinton, right? And no, some Democrats are still clinging to the Bernie phenomenon. They're feeling the burn no matter what. What do you think about that?
Oh, I think it's just hilarious. And I think more than anything, it speaks to how horrible of a candidate Hillary Clinton is. I mean, come on. These people are clinging to this like radical socialist from Vermont who has this history. He's not even a Democrat. He's an independent. That just speaks to how little choice that people on the left had this election cycle. They're so desperate for anybody but Hillary. I mean, we have Never Trump on the right. Honestly, there's a ton of Bernie's people who are never Hillary on the left. So I just think it speaks to how weak of a candidate she is, even unpopular among her own party. It's great. I love it.
You know, you mentioned Never Trump, and I think I'd be remiss if I didn't at least ask one specific Never Trump question. In your estimation, based on people you talk to and everything you're seeing out there, is there any way that Donald Trump's actions, never mind, like put aside the fact that I think Hillary is going to be a unifier, this always happens, right? You've got an election with two people, two parties, there's going to be consolidation at the polls. This is the way it tends to happen. Is there enough, though, right? Is it enough for one side to win or the other? That's the big question. Now I sound like one of these football announcers who's like, whoever has more points on the board wins. But still, do you think that there's anything Trump can do? Forget about whether Hillary unifies the party. Trump's tone, Trump's policies, Trump's actions, his outreach. Do you think there's a way that he could at least open the minds of some never Trumpers to becoming maybe Trumpers, or do you think that it's just too far, too much, and it won't matter? He won't be able to do enough of it for it to matter.
Well, yeah, absolutely. I think he has one secret weapon for courting the never Trump folks, and that's his VP slot. So say Donald Trump picks the VP of Marco Rubio, adds Marco Rubio to his ticket. I think that changes minds among some never Trump people, absolutely. So I think he's really got quite a weapon to wield there, and he's going to have to make a careful decision if he wants to woo never Trump folks. But I think that's a pretty powerful thing.
I mean, yeah, I could foresee a situation. Let's say he makes Rubio his VP. Let's say he makes a promise, for whatever that's worth, but he makes a promise, a public promise, a pledge to put Ted Cruz on the Supreme Court. You know, I feel like there are ways he's going to make Carly Fiorina Secretary of State, right? I mean, I feel like there are ways that he could position. Now, look, people are probably, I can already feel some of my audience, there's a lot of Cruz supporters throwing the virtual tomatoes at me even for bringing this up. But I think we should at least war game it a little bit. I think there are some things that Donald Trump could do to make him more palatable to a broader swath of the GOP. Whether he'll do them or not, I don't know. But I do think it is possible, at least.
That's the question. So I think it's possible he could go in that direction. I think what's even scarier, though, is that I could totally see him going in the other direction and completely 180, you know, no interest in really courting the conservative base once he's won the nomination. So once he's coronated as a Republican nominee, I can see him doing very little potentially to really court real conservatives or Republicans, because he's on the ticket, he's going to do what it takes to get elected, whether or not that does anything for the Republican base. But like you're saying, he could go in the other direction, and if it is a matter strategically of consolidating conservative voters, turning them out to the polls, yeah, maybe doing the opposite and courting the conservative base is his best bet. We'll have to see, but that's what's really scary, is the element of the unknown there.
What is your confidence level? And I understand that even pollsters will say at this point, nobody knows. But based on all the factors as you assess them right now, what do you think is likely to be the tone and trajectory of the Trump campaign going forward as a GOP nominee? What do you think is likely to happen with the Clinton campaign as they roll out both the sort of Clinton machinery and then around it the broader DNC machinery, although they're kind of inextricably linked, right? It's like a shark and a remora. What do you think are the chances that Trump can win?
I think the polling right now is pretty skewed towards Hillary Clinton. I think people are going to be very, very surprised come late summer by how well Trump does against Clinton, because I think he has so much to tap into, and I think he's really the Trump stands for everything the American people don't like about Hillary Clinton, or at least he's able to convince people he does. So I think that's so powerful moving forward. I think people are really underestimating him against Hillary Clinton. So I think people might be surprised by how he does.
All right. We will have to see. Emily, we'll have to have you back to talk more about this as we see more of what the future holds for this absolutely insane and unpredictable campaign thus far. Emily Jasinski, she's a program officer for PR at Young America's Foundation. Emily, really appreciate your time today. Thank you for calling in.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's good to be here.
All right, Team Buck, much more coming. 888-900-3393. Stay with me.
Buck Sexton. The Blaze Radio Network.
Dispensing the truth. This is Buck Sexton
on the Blaze Radio Network.
Phones are open, team. 888-900-3393. Also, facebook.com/Buck Sexton. If you are listening and you have not already liked the page, please do so. And if you have a chance, give me a call. What do you think about what happened last night? I'm sure you guys have thoughts. And gals. I'm sure you have thoughts. I meant the royal guys, as in non-gender specific. No gender specificity there. Rich in White Plains. We haven't talked in a couple days. What's up, buddy?
Hey, Buck. Buck, you're familiar with the phrase scorched earth policy, aren't you?
Yes, sir.
Well, this is what I think about when I hear these ridiculous Trump supporters like former Massachusetts Senator Scott Brown asking for conservatives to unite behind Trump. Trump engaged in the most disgusting campaign in recent GOP history, eliminating his competition by winning a debate not on the issues, but by engaging in the tactics of personal destruction, culminating with this accusation that Cruz's father participated in the Kennedy assassination. So to think that conservatives will back another non-conservative is not only like Lucy pulling the football out from Charlie Brown, but the sheer lack of character and principles by Trump will result in a record number of conservatives either not voting or voting for another candidate. And add to that the diminished numbers in the black, Hispanic, women's demographic, plus the new attacks we will be seeing from the predominantly liberal media, and it all spells loser for Trump.
I'm getting the sense, Rich, and correct me if I'm wrong here, but I'm getting the sense you are never Trump.
Let's address that, Buck. Never Trump. You know, the default to the never
Trump. Wait, we don't have a yes or no here? Or you got to give me a yes or no before you address it.
All right. Yeah, it's a yes. I'm a no. I'm a
okay. So, yeah. So I'm right. But go ahead. Continue.
Well, then everybody goes to the default position. Oh, but we can't have Hillary. Okay? That's the standard bearer's answer to, gee, you have to vote for Trump. And I say no. I say that we've been dying, this country, dying a death of a thousand cuts ever since Reagan with either a moderate president or a liberal president. And I just see Trump as continuing the death by a thousand cuts and Hillary just getting it over quicker.
Do you have any good news, Rich? What do you think about Kasich dropping out?
Did Kasich drop out?
Yeah, man. I just said in the first hour.
Oh, that's news to me. When did he do it?
Yeah, he just did. Isn't that awesome? It's hilarious, right? He was in. He just wanted to be the second. He just wanted the silver medal in the GOP primary, and I guess technically he gets it. But,
he
just dropped out.
I'm sure he dropped out because all of the pressure the media put on him to do so. Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, all the pressure that media, common sense, the RNC, and everybody. Rich, I think it's time for you to start a podcast, my friend. You got a lot of political thoughts. I mean that in a complimentary way. You got a lot of thoughts. You should give that a whirl. Rich from White Plains. Always a pleasure, sir. Thank you very much for calling in. Good to talk to you. No, I mean that. You can start a podcast. It's fun. People listen to it. Make some new friends. It's cool. I like my podcast. It's fun. Good times. 888-900-3393. Got a lot to talk to you about in the next hour. We're going to be switching all kinds of topics up. Going to be covering a lot of territory today, team. Got a very full show, a whole panoply of topics to cover. So it'll be fun. Plus, maybe I'll throw in some weird words just because I like to spice things up around here. You could say that I like to make sure the Freedom Hut is a spicy meatball. Hour two starts in just a few minutes. Don't go anywhere. I'll be right back.
You're listening to Buck Sexton on the Blaze Radio Network. Spreading freedom across the nation. This is
the Buck Sexton Show.
Team Buck, welcome back to the Freedom Hut. Hour two is kicking off right now. Very excited to have you with me. Remember when we used to talk about Obamacare a lot? The signature legislative achievement of President Obama, the single biggest law that he has passed during his 8 years, or passed under his tenure of 8 years in office. Well, Hillary Clinton says she's going to continue on with the legacy. She loves Obamacare. This is what she had to say about it in February. Play it.
I want to defend the Affordable Care Act. It is one of the great accomplishments, not only of this president, but of the Democratic Party going back to Harry Truman.
Ooh, one of the great accomplishments of the Democratic Party. Well, what's actually happening with Obamacare in 2016? You probably haven't heard that much about it, other than the occasional soundbite from Hillary, or Republicans maybe saying they will repeal it. What is really going on with this law? We are joined now by Nicole Fisher. She is the founder of HHR Strategies. Nicole, great to have you on board. Thanks for calling in.
Hello, thank you.
All right, so let's do a sort of a soup to nuts rundown here of what's been going on with Obamacare in 2016. The first thing is, I just did a Google search, Nicole, this morning before we're going to have you on, because I needed to update myself on Obamacare. Not that much coverage of it these days. The biggest thing that comes up is, oh, wait a second, some of the largest insurers in the country are like, I can't stay in this thing, losing too much money, including United, which I think, what did it say, lost $650 million this year, this past year alone, United Healthcare Group. which was the largest insurer in the country. They've pulled out of Obamacare exchanges. Others may follow. What is going on?
Mm-hmm. You're exactly right. Well, what we're seeing is what we expected to see, especially between 2016 and 2018. The cost to employers are going to continue to increase. Insurers have been sort of playing roulette in different states, seeing what happens. They're winning a little bit here and there, losing a lot in other places. And so what we're seeing is that employers, I think up to one-third, expect that the greatest increases are going to take place in 2016. But again, we're going to see the costs continue to increase in 2018, which is when that Cadillac tax kicks in. So from here, for the next couple years, it could be a really bumpy road.
Now, what is it? Just explain to everybody, what does the Cadillac tax mean? Because it sounds like if you don't buy like my grandparents' favorite brand of car, then you're okay. But no, the Cadillac tax means what?
I mean, ultimately, it's a non-deductible 40% excise tax that's levied on plans that go beyond thresholds. And so basically this tax will be applied whether premiums are paid by the employer or the employee. So it could hit a lot of people. Now, it's still, you know, being kicked around on the Hill, as are a lot of these things. And you said, you know, we haven't been talking about the ACA much in 2016. As a health policy advisor, for better or worse, I still am every day. And this is the Cadillac tax is one of the things that's going to be coming up. People will start to hear more and more about it as employers and employees become more afraid of the cost.
Now, there's also the chance of a major, I mean, I saw this in Politico earlier in the week. There is a chance, and of course, for Politico, that means there's a fear because they want Hillary Clinton to win. There's a chance that there'll be a big spike in premiums right before the elections. At least that's the way it's slated to go right now. Do you think that there'll be, do you think the Obama administration, to give a little helping hand, will engage in some shenanigans to make sure that they do what? I mean, can they funnel more taxpayer subsidy towards so that the increases are smaller? I mean, how can they try to game the system? Because it seems like if you had a double-digit increase, let's say, roughly speaking, across the board for healthcare premiums based that you know involve the exchanges, that people might freak out right in time to decide they don't want to vote for the party of Obamacare, which is the Democrats.
Yes, and we've seen this before, so you're exactly right. I wouldn't be surprised if the administration did exactly that. In the past, we've seen it before midterm elections. There were things that were supposed to go into place per the president's, you know, 5 and 10 year plans. And what they did is ended up postponing certain things so that they kicked in after the election. And so I think we'll see something very similar. I also think there's such pushback from whether it's small businesses or providers, hospital systems, and now we're seeing insurers. I think the president has shifted his focus. To your point, we're not hearing as much about this and how wonderful it is. And so I think what we'll see is around election time that things are going to just subtly get moved. Deadlines will be pushed back. We'll probably see them move to, probably after inauguration, so February, March, something like that, so that no one has to deal with them until someone else is in office.
And one thing that I saw in one of these articles about this was that there was a CEO, an insurance lawyer, rather, when they were asking around about, hey, what are we going to do? We've got more sick people in the exchanges than anticipated, older people than anticipated for it to be a sort of a balanced pool, right? Because this whole thing is about the redistributing of healthcare, therefore the redistributing of wealth from some people to others. What do we do about this? And one guy quoted in this political piece said it about the individual mandate and the way that it is currently structured with the fine as either a percentage of income or a flat fine, depending on which is more. He said, quote, it wasn't enough of a hammer. You need a lot of healthy people to sign up to make the numbers work. Obviously, that didn't happen. That, to me, is a very important little data point there, because not enough of a hammer. What they mean by that is, well, if you get a Democrat into office again, they're just going to find a way to add into the law. I mean, I know currently it's structured a certain way, but there's nothing to stop Democrats if they have the legislative authority to do it. And maybe it's even under HHS discretion. I'd have to look at the specifics in the law to raise the fines substantially, right? To force more people into the exchanges, because that's part of the problem is they can't get enough people who are otherwise healthy to take part in this.
This is true. And we've had this discussion several times over the last few years, and it comes up in different ways about what that penalty could be or should be or what they'll try to get away with. I think at present, we come back to an argument that was started around, 2010 when all this was really up for debate. And that is ultimately who will push people onto the exchange. And you and I have had this conversation before, and I think the example we used was Walmart. And with that many employers, if the penalty is, say, $2,000 a person, you look at who their average employee is. It's a single mother. So a woman who automatically costs more, plus children who can be costly, all of a sudden $2,000 a person seems actually like a really great deal of a penalty for Walmart to pay as opposed to insuring the employee. Now, we've not seen that happen yet. It was a big threat. But I think as those costs start to change over the years, we're going to see, for especially large corporations, where that threshold is and at what point they say, okay, well, I'd rather pay the penalty. And the administration's going to have to try and handle that. And they're probably going to have to try and tackle it from several different directions.
And do we have a good sense yet of, because I've heard Hillary Clinton at least indicate, if not outright say, that she believes that illegal immigrants who are in the country, especially illegal immigrants who are covered under any form of executive amnesty, the stay on deportations, they should have access to the exchanges, i.e., they should be able to get Obamacare. Do we have any? I mean, we were originally promised, by the way, by President Obama. I remember hearing the clips. I've gone back and researched it just to be sure I'm not imagining it. And he said that would never happen. Now Hillary's saying, no, well, if you're covered under the Obama deportation stay and, you can buy into the exchange, well, then sure. So, in fact, it looks like there is a high chance that some illegals will get access to Obamacare, which is subsidized health care. Do we have any numbers on that, or is there anything to indicate that that's not going to happen, that they won't be able to buy into the exchanges? What's your sense of that?
We have no way of knowing whether they will or won't. I mean, it really will depend on the next administration and what happens with immigration reform as a whole. So you're not only looking at healthcare reform, you're looking at immigration reform in this nasty place where those start to overlap. At present, we have what's called EMTALA. It's the Emergency Medical Treatment Law. And ultimately, it says anyone who shows up to an emergency department will receive care. And the people that receive care, even if they're illegal, will not be turned in and, deported right away. They go through the system like everyone else. So because of that, there is access to care. However, being able to join the exchange, it's really up to the next president and HHS. And I think under a Hillary administration, and depending on who's at the helm of HHS, I think they could do it pretty easily.
Yeah, I would put money on it. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's an article today in the Washington Times about how people always say that illegals can't access welfare benefits. Totally a lie. But the welfare agencies don't care. It's government money. Who cares? But we'll move on from that for a second. To everyone listening right now, we're kind of having this discussion, and this is because I want to know the ins and outs, and you're somebody who has the wonkery to apply to the situation to tell me exactly where this law is going and what it's been doing in 2016. But for everybody listening, what does the Obamacare law mean for them now, if anything? Does it mean that they're, even if they're in, let's say, employer-sponsored healthcare, are their costs going up? Can they expect their costs will go up? For individuals who either don't get into the exchange or are in the exchange, what should they think is going to happen in the future?
I think costs will continue to go up for the next couple of years. It's because with each new year or 6 month period, we're seeing small pieces that, had been kicked down the road a few years ago that will slowly be implemented. And so I think employers, there's inherently going to be added costs, not only by insuring more people, but having to meet greater requirements. I think even if you go to the paperwork, the HR that's associated with the changes that come, there are going to be costs. I recently spoke at an Association of CPAs conference, and when they called me, I thought, oh, they have the wrong phone number. But in the end, what I did is I actually gave a talk about what it means for them. And basically what we agreed is that the manuals they use as CPAs are useless, because every 6 months, by the time they get the new one in the mail, it's already outdated when it comes to healthcare. So I think with those ever-changing rules and regulations and additions, the next few years, you know, we're going to see costs go up. What we're seeing is people choose the high-deductible health plans. I think they're popular amongst employers. It's a way to kind of hold the line as best they can at the moment. As I said, you know, in 2018, there's a good chance the Cadillac tax will kick in. And I think those high-deductible health plans will become even more popular if that's the case. I can imagine that Republicans will do everything in their power to keep that from happening. But it's really, maybe you'll hear the fear in my voice, but it's really up to the next president and head of HHS as to what happens.
All right. So this is something, in case there wasn't enough riding on the next election, the Supreme Court, some would say the future of the Republic. You can also pile on top of that your health care, the costs, the quality of the care, and all the rest of it because of Obamacare. Nicole Fisher, founder of HHR Strategies. We really appreciate you joining, Nicole. Thanks for calling in.
Thank you. Have a great day.
You too. Team, the phone lines are open. 888-900-3393. Also on Twitter at Buck Sexton. Live tweeting throughout the show. We have so many ways to talk. No excuses not for us to have a back and forth. Unless you're busy with work, that's cool. Or you're taking care of the kids and got to do other things. That's also cool. But theoretically, there are lots of ways for you to contact me. We'll be back after this break. Oh, in fact, we'll be back after this break after I tell you about a fantastic sponsor of this show, Yankee Hill Machine. I want to welcome to the Buck Sexton show, Yankee Hill Machine, YHM. YHM designs, develops, and manufactures top quality firearms and accessories, and they do it right here in the United States of America. You're like, well, tell me about Yankee Hill, Buck. You know what? I'm going to do that for you right now. It's a third generation family owned company. They are proudly celebrating their 65th anniversary in business. Been around for 65 years. I mean, what else do you really have to know? They obviously make top quality stuff. They came from humble beginnings in Florence, Massachusetts. YHM originally was just a simple job shop. They were making cleaning kits for the U.S. government, and they modeled their first rifle, believe it or not, after a reproduction of a black powder musket. Now, yeah, look, a lot has changed since 1951, but YHM's commitment to quality, performance, and value hasn't changed a bit. The current owners, Chris and Kevin Graham, stay true to follow the family tradition and produce some of the finest rifles and sound suppressors on the market. Their continued innovations have made YHM a strong force in the AR-15 and more recently, even in the sound suppression industry. So for the complete line of YHM products, go to YHM.net, YHM.net. Again, that is YHM.net. Yankee Hill Machine. Check them out, team. Back in a few.
This is the Buck Sexton Show
on the Blaze Radio Network. The Buck Sexton Show on the Blaze Radio Network.
Let's take a call from Darby down in Dallas. Darby, you are on the Buck Sexton Show, sir. It is a pleasure. Welcome. Darby in Dallas?
Real briefly.
Hey, yes, sir. What's
I'm
up?
Here, you there?
Yes, sir. Hey, indeed.
I wanted to comment on your last guest. As a registered nurse, I can tell you that as far as the illegals receiving care, she's 100% accurate. I've worked in probably 7 or 8 different ERs in my career, and anyone can walk into an emergency room and be treated for any reason without any questions, and so they're already getting it. But my main reason my call was that I thought that Ted Cruz did what was the honorable thing last night, and I appreciate the fact that he did it. I also think that your analysis is 100% accurate. If others had dropped out sooner, the trajectory of the primary might have been different. But I think that the main thing that we need to focus on right now is that all of these never Trump people need to take a real hard, long look at Hillary Clinton and ask themselves if they're willing to let her be the president for the next 4 or probably 8 years. Because if they're willing to wait and say, well, we'll pick it up on the other side, there may not be another side. She will, we know, nominate 1 Supreme Court justice, probably 2. Obamacare will continue, and the longer it stays, the more likely it is that we'll be with us forever. So my fear is that she would do irreparable damage to the country, and it scares me to death to think that people that are mad at Donald Trump, that they don't agree with him, and to be honest, I don't agree with him either. But I would rather have a turned-up mop with a bucket for a head as president than Hillary Clinton. She is terrible.
Well, so. I will say this, that this idea of, like, well, we'll hold the line against Hillary and better to be in opposition. And as this gets closer, this is a continuing conversation, and I don't have all the answers. I just have thoughts, and, you know, I'll share them with everybody, and they can share them with me. The idea, though, that conceding more or less, however you want to define conceding, but if Hillary Clinton is in the White House for 8 years, we're talking about almost another decade of far left progressive rule from the White House, which, as we know, is increasing in its power with each passing year. That's certainly not going to change under Hillary's time in office. And that we can just sort of sustain that the damage to liberty and the damage to individual rights and to the Constitution will be somehow, not that bad over the course of an 8-year Hillary presidency is, I think that's ludicrous. I mean, you already mentioned the Supreme Court. Sure, that's there as well. But the country is changing in ways that are very hard to anticipate. But when you look at the trajectories, the progressives are getting their way time and again, right? Government is only getting bigger. The debt is only getting bigger. The laws are only favoring the leftists and the statists more and more. I mean, I can't think of the last time a law was passed that was sort of sweeping in scope. I mean, maybe Citizens United, but all Citizens United did was keep the First Amendment from becoming an absolute joke. I mean, you've got the federal government arguing that it has the right to ban books in an election season, everybody. That was their position in Citizens United. You can look it up. You'll be like, what? Banning books? Yep, banning books. Because of the brilliance of things like McCain-Feingold and campaign finance and have to prevent big money in politics. So, Darby, I'm with you on as we get closer to this, 8 years of a Hillary presidency, that's not a reality we can sort of just walk into and be like, it's okay. It's not okay.
Agree 100%. Thank you, sir.
All right, Darby, thank you for your time. Thank you for calling in. Team, I have many things to discuss with you. We have many topics to consider, many places to go. Join me in this quest by basically staying exactly where you are. And maybe tell Phil in accounting he should listen in, too.
The Buck Sexton Show on the Blaze Radio Network.
Listening to the Buck Sexton Show only on the Blaze Radio Network.
Oh, team, it is one of these issues that I have to say, you look at it and it's almost hard to believe sometimes. Hard to believe that it's as politicized as it is. And then you look deeper in the issue, you go, of course. Guns shouldn't be a right-left issue. They really shouldn't. And I know this sounds kind of like, what, Buck? You're talking crazy talk. Because, of course, there are a huge right-left issue. But that's because of things that really have nothing to do with guns, with firearms. It's about showing people or telling people that you're the right kind of person. Because there's been this huge campaign with Democrats for quite a while now to demonize gun ownership, to make gun owners seem irresponsible, to make them seem like they're heartless. They don't care about the dead children of Sandy Hook Elementary. I mean, you know, that's what the media does. That's what the Democrat left does, despite the fact that, as a friend of mine who was a Marine Recon used to say, a guy I did some work with overseas, gun is just a tool. I mean, it's a tool that you can also, you know, it can be used for sport, it can be used for fun, but for his job and his work, it's like a gun is a tool. It's all it is. It's not an object with any moral implications. It is an object. It is just a thing. It is a tool. It has a use. And the use can be for pleasure, can be for sport, can be for defense, can be for any number of things, right? And Democrats, you look at the partisan divide on this, and it's pretty astonishing. Here you have registered voters overall are more concerned than the government would go too far in restricting gun rights than failed to do enough to regulate firearms. This is from the Wall Street Journal. But the survey that they did, an NBC News Wall Street Journal poll, but there's a deep partisan divide, with 74% of Democrat voters saying they're worried the government would do too little about guns, and 73% of Republicans worried the government would do too much. I mean, this is a strictly down the middle partisan divide kind of an issue. And the old days, even, by the way, of the sort of the, what is it, the blue dog gun toting Democrats, whatever they used to call themselves, those are pretty much gone. That's largely gone now. You don't hear about that anymore because guns have become a social issue. In fact, guns have become an issue of social justice, even. Of course, what's fascinating is that there's no specific effort to restrict guns from the inner city. They just want to restrict guns across the board. And you look at cases like Vermont, where you have very lax gun laws, Bernie Sanders' home state. So this has come up a lot. And you look at that, circumstance, and you say to yourself, OK, well, why isn't there more gun violence there? And I leave it to somebody else to crunch the numbers and tell me what the answer is. But all I know is that it's possible for a state to have lax gun laws because this exists already and almost no gun crime whatsoever. So gun laws do not equate to gun crime, or I should say loose gun laws or friendly gun laws or Second Amendment compliant gun laws do not equate with crime. But again, it's really, as with climate change, it has very little to do with the issue at hand. It has to do with the emotionalized component of everything that's going on, right? It has to do with how this is portrayed in the media. It's about protecting kids and all the rest of it. But it's not actually about gun ownership. And so the people who are the loudest voices that want to restrict guns right now in the political sphere are just demagogues, right? I mean, you've got Hillary Clinton, for example. And John, do we have any of these gun clips? Let me know if we've pulled some of them. We're trying to get some. Let me know when you get it. Hillary Clinton, this was on Google. On January 6th, she said, or she wrote, I don't know, one or the other, more than 33,000 Americans are killed by guns each year. It's time to act. As president, I'll take on the gun lobby and fight for common sense reforms to keep guns away from terrorists, domestic abusers, and other violent criminals, including comprehensive background checks and closing loopholes that allow guns to fall into the wrong hands. Okay. Guns already require background checks. So I don't know what, I don't know how many more times we have to go over this. There's the NICS system, National Instant Criminal, Criminal Background Check System. The so-called gun show loophole is not a loophole. I mean, there's all this stuff that they say, right? And she suggests that they're going to dramatically decrease the 33,000 people a year who are killed by guns. And keep in mind, that's including suicides. We have Hillary talking about guns. Oh, we got Obama talking about guns, he's going to do a handoff of gun control from his administration to Hillary's. But let's play. This is what Obama says recently about guns and gun control. Play it.
Today, many gun injuries and deaths are the result of legal guns that were stolen or misused or discharged accidentally. In 2013 alone, more than 500 people lost their lives to gun accidents, and that includes 30 children younger than 5 years old. Now, in the greatest, most technologically advanced nation on Earth, there is no reason for this. We need to develop new technologies that make guns safer. If we can set it up so you can't unlock your phone unless you got the right fingerprint, why can't we do the same thing for our guns?
A lot of reasons that I'll get into in a second.
There's an app that can help us find a missing tablet, which happens to me often, the older I get. If we can do it for your iPad, there's no reason we can't do it with a stolen gun. If a child can't open a bottle of aspirin, We should make sure that they can't pull a trigger on a gun. Right?
Oh, yeah. Clap, clap. The demagoguery is stifling, isn't it? Let's talk about this for a moment, shall we? First of all, oh, gosh, so many ways, so many places to go with this. The children who die in gun accidents, you're almost always talking about somebody who, well, you really, by definition, are talking about somebody who did not properly store their firearm. You're usually also talking about someone who put a firearm in a place and left it loaded. And, you know, there's a degree of negligence involved here. Now, in New York City, for example, if you want to go through the process of having a gun, which means, by the way, you have to change your address with the police. You have to let them know, in addition to moving and all that hassle, you have to let them know where you're moving and change your permit or else it's forfeit. You could actually get in a lot of trouble for it. I knew a case of somebody in New York City who sent in the check to have their long gun permit for a shotgun that the guy was using for clay pigeons. The long gun permit, he had to send in payment because, you know, this is a right you have to pay for, by the way, right? It should be considered no different than being told, hey, you want to vote? $50. But no, in New York City, you know, it's like $400 or $500, something like that, to get a handgun permit. I don't know what it is for a long gun permit. Now, I refuse to do it. People say, Buck, you should do it. No, I'm not going to do it. And it's not because I don't like shooting and I don't like guns. It's because I refuse to de facto give the police entry into my apartment at any point, which you do, by the way, because they can always inspect your fire. They have the right to inspect under New York City law your firearm at any point, any time of their choosing. You say, oh, Buck, they're not going to do that. Yeah, I don't care. I don't want the police to be able to say we're coming in to inspect your guns. That's not the way it's supposed to work. So I object in principle to it. And, oh, I also don't want to be in a situation where I move and I forget and, you know, there's some minor, mishap, unintentional, and all of a sudden, you know, they've got the cuffs on me and I'm downtown and I'm told that, you know, I'm facing some kind of a gun charge. So, no, I won't do it. And I was telling about this individual, it was sort of a friend, but it was from a good source. And he had a long gun permit in New York City, which is like a commie anti-gun zone, and sent in because remember, you have to pay for this right. This is the only right that I'm aware of. We have to pay for it. OK, your Second Amendment right in New York, at least, you have to pay money for. You got to write checks to them. Not even just once. You got to sort of re-up it. They make it as painful as possible so that compliance is such a headache that you'd rather cede your rights. And in my case, that you'd rather cede your Fourth Amendment rights, and I'm just not going to do it. You know, I was trained by the federal government with sidearms, long gun, machine guns, all kinds of fun stuff. Can't exercise my Second Amendment rights here as a normal citizen. Can't do it. But so this guy, I'm sorry, I keep getting away from the main story. You're like, Buck, what happened? He sent in his check to re-up his long. Remember, this is like a shot. This is a double-barreled shotgun for sporting clay. For shooting sporting clays. I would want to know when the last time is somebody went into a store or a bank and they were like, pardon me, sir, with my 20 gauge here, I demand you fill these bags full of your finest coinage. I don't think that happens. Okay. I don't think anyone's gone in there with an engraved hunting shotgun worth lots and lots of money and all of this. Anyway, that was the case. You know what they did, by the way? He sent in a check. It wasn't a certified check. So you know what they did down at One Police Plaza, the main police headquarters here, the gun office? Nothing. They took the check and they threw it out because it wasn't certified. It has to be certified. The guy didn't know that. He said he had the money. It wasn't like it bounced. But you know what they did do? They marked in the system non-payment for re-upping his gun. And you know what happened? The police showed up to his apartment in front of his family and I don't believe they arrested him, but he obviously thought they were going to, but they did seize his gun. And he was like, look, I paid you guys. I mean, I sent the check. I mean, you know, I'm sorry, wasn't certified. Your gun is ours now. This guy, I mean, I know the guy. You'd meet him and within 30 seconds, you'd trust him to watch your family. I mean, you know, he's a nice guy, wife, kids, good job, you know. Least likely person, it's not going to commit a crime. I mean, it's just crazy. But this is what the statist progressives like to do, like to harass, and they like to show how tough they are on guns because they don't like gun violence. The rest of us love gun violence, but they don't like gun violence.
So stupid. You got Obama out there saying, oh, it's harder to open a bottle of aspirin. Okay, what about an aspirin bottle that's already opened? That's the more, you know, if somebody leaves a loaded handgun on the kitchen table with the safety off, and God forbid, but it does happen, some kid gets his hands on it, that's negligence. So don't tell me, oh, an aspirin bottle, it's the same. No, it would be like saying, you know, we should really tell parents, you know, not to leave plastic bags by a baby's crib because the baby, it's like, yeah, of course not. That would be negligence, right? We're aware. Doesn't mean we stop making plastic bags. Or we don't leave aspirin out there. Doesn't mean we should stop making aspirin. But with guns, let's make it basically impossible. In New York City also, by the way, you have to have, and I know you're in the rest of the country where you have guns and you have the Second Amendment and it's actually respected. Laugh away, because in New York it's preposterous. I don't know where the NRA is on this. I heard they were going to sue and they haven't. And come on. It's too expensive. It's too onerous. It's preposterous in New York City. It's the biggest city in the country of 8 million people. And there's plenty of guns here. You should talk to my friends when I worked the NYPD who would talk about one parade. I don't want to say which one because, you know, microaggression. One parade that would happen in particular where people would take automatic weapons and go up onto the roofs of a certain neighborhood in New York and fire them up in the air. And they use a certain sonic detection technology to try to find them because they don't, you know, apparently these people don't realize you fire a whole bunch of 9mm rounds in the air. They come down and they hit people and they can kill them. But yeah, that's how they were celebrating. So people have automatic weapons in the city who shouldn't have any weapons. And yet you want a shotgun, you better hope that you send a certified check or else they're coming for you. And Obama wants to lecture us on how, oh, you know, it's aspirin bottles. Oh, you know, it's just nonsense. It's absolute nonsense. And Hillary Clinton's going to continue. We'll talk about Hillary on the flip side. This gun thing gets me very agitated, as you can see. See, team, we have so much to talk about. We could do like a 5-hour show today without sitting here just being like Trump, 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 Trump. Nope, sorry. This isn't the Trump hut. It's the Freedom hut. Back in a few.
Buck Sexton on the Blaze Radio Network. Sexton Show.
All right, team. So, by the way, in case you think that any of this is going to stop when Hillary Clinton becomes the nominee of the Democratic Party, not going to go further than that. But in case you're wondering what her plan would be as president, she hates guns. She's very clear about that. She actually thinks there are just too many of them, flat out. Play the clip.
We have just too many guns on the streets, in our homes, in our neighborhoods. And, you know, there's been a lot of talk in this campaign, in the primary campaign, about the power of certain interests in our country. And we do have a bunch of powerful interests, make no mistake about it. But there is no more powerful lobby than the gun lobby.
Not really, you know, it's all about the gun lobby. It's not about gun owners, right? It's not about the Second Amendment. It's not about people actually having the right to keep and bear arms. I find Hillary on this as disingenuous as she is on anything else, but that is really just her default setting, right? It's like HDMI 1 disingenuous. Like, that's what happens when you turn on Hillary. I just don't know what it's going to take for, well, it's never going to change because it's a social issue for Democrats, actually. Remember, gun control is not about stopping people from being shot. It's not about ending violence in inner cities or any area for that matter. Gun control is about the statists having more authority over citizens. And in the short term, it's about people feeling good about themselves. It's like climate change. It's like recycling. Yeah, you're one of the good people because you don't like the mean gun people. That's really all it boils down to. It's PR for the Democrats. Team, third hour. I got a ton of awesome guests. You're going to want to stay with me. Don't go anywhere.
The Buck Sexton Show.
Only on the Blaze Radio Network. spreading freedom across the nation. This is
The Buck Sexton Show.
Team Buck, welcome back to the Freedom Hut. We are kicking it off with Hour 3. A little refresher. Yesterday, we talked about Hillary Clinton, what she cares about, and whom she pretends to care about. She promised that she would do, well, exactly what's already being done, which is make it harder for people in the coal mining industry to make a living. You don't have to take my word for it. Take her word for it. Play the clip.
I'm the only candidate which has a policy about how to bring economic opportunity using clean, renewable energy as the key into coal country, because we're going to put a lot of coal miners and coal companies out of business. Right, Tim? And we're going to make it clear that we don't want to forget those people. Those people labored in those mines for generations, losing
right.
their health.
She said that she wanted to put them out of business, and that means people are going to lose their jobs. Well, one American who lost his job had the opportunity to actually ask Mrs. Clinton about this very issue. Bo Copley, who is a coal miner, joins us now. Bo, thank you for giving us some of your time today.
Thank you for having me, Bud.
So, Bo, you had the chance to speak face-to-face with Secretary Clinton on this issue. We played the audio right before you came on. Seems to me that the layoffs that have occurred in your industry, including a layoff that has affected you and your family personally, is not just a policy that the Democrats and people like Hillary Clinton are responsible for. Until they're confronted with it, they seem rather proud of it. What's your sense?
We kind of have the same feeling that it's no secret that the current administration and what would be her administration, in my opinion, if she were elected, seem to be set on renewable energies, cleaner energies, and we just feel that coal is a God-given resource in our area that if the EPA restrictions on us were not set right now to completely drive us out of the industry, we could compete and could be cleaner than what we were in the past. But you've got to be allowed to mine the coal and get it out of the ground to be able to use it in a clean coal technology.
Can you tell everybody listening how much damage has been done to your industry? How many coal miners, how many people work in the coal industry like yourself have been affected, and how damaging has it been to parts of this country that are reliant on those coal mines for jobs?
Well, in our area especially, it's been devastating. We've had thousands of coal miners that have been laid off in the most recent administration. And it's not just our industry that takes a hit. When you lay off coal miners in our area, there's a trickle-down effect. For every coal miner that's out of work, you're probably looking 5 to 7 people that may lose their job also. You don't have the money to go to Walmart. You don't have money to go out and shop. You don't have the opportunities for other jobs, so you move away. So classrooms get smaller. Schools lose funding because they don't have the same kind of classroom.
Right, the tax base is less. Yeah.
Yes.
Let me ask you specifically about your exchange with Hillary Clinton, if I may. She seemed to indicate, because she knew the cameras were there and everything, and I'm very upfront about this, Bo. I believe Hillary Clinton is a deeply dishonest woman, and I'm not going to put you in the spot and ask you what you think necessarily, but I'm just telling you that's where I come from. I think she's a very dishonest person. Okay. So with that aired out there, you got to look her in the eye and tell her what you thought about her comments. She claimed that it was a misstatement or that it was taken out of context. I played the audio yesterday. Did you believe that?
Not 100%. I had not heard the entire clip of what she had said before. I had heard parts of it. I went back and listened to it and to give her the benefit of the doubt and to take her at her word. But I honestly, with the way she says it, it just seems like she's proud about the part where she says we're going to put a lot of coal miners and coal companies out of work.
That's what it sounds like to me. And she was bragging about it beforehand, and now she sees people like you, and this has really affected you, obviously, and this is your industry, this is your career, this is what you do, this is how you provide for your family. Bo, I just want to, I'm sure everyone listening wants to know, you know, how are you doing, how's your family doing, and what are your plans going into the future here?
Well, Buck, honestly, we are a blessed family. God has, we do our best to live right and live our life the way that we feel God leads us to live it. And he has blessed us tremendously. My wife is a professional photographer, started out as a hobby of hers that God knew what was going on, and he placed that in our lives so that when the time came, that's now our main source of income. Charlie Lifestyle Photography is my wife's business, and she has supported us in it, and God has been faithful to us, and we have really, we've done well. We are fortunate. Other people in from where we're from, their wives have used to being stay-at-home moms, and they don't have jobs to fall back on, and we have been really fortunate and blessed by our Creator that we have her business to fall back on.
Right. Well, I'm happy to hear that you and your family are doing okay through all this, and that makes everyone listening, I think, feel quite a bit better about this story. But it is also important for us all to hear what you told us about how coal industry is just getting hammered and a lot of people losing jobs. And as you say, those are friends and colleagues of yours, and they're people that don't necessarily have somebody else that can help provide in the household and aren't as fortunate as you are. Bo, I really appreciate you joining us today. I know you're not a media guy, but you know, we need to hear from people who are actually experiencing it themselves, and God bless you. And you know, you're a brave man to go up there and tell Hillary Clinton what you thought face to face. We appreciate it.
Well, thank you for having me on. I appreciate the opportunity.
Absolutely, Bo. You take care of yourself. You take care of your family. All right, team, we're going to go into a break. We'll be right back.
You're listening to The Buck Sexton Show on the Blaze Radio Network. This is The Buck Sexton Show.
Team, we're now joined by my old friend from the Real News days and currently a Fox News contributor, Pete Hegseth. He has a new book out, In the Arena, Good Citizens, A Great Republic, and How One Speech Can Reinvigorate America. Pete Hegseth. Captain Hegseth, thank you for coming in.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be inside the cozy Freedom Hut.
Yeah, the Freedom Hut is a snug place indeed. So, Pete, tell me a bit about this book. In the Arena, I see there's you and there's Teddy Roosevelt. I won't ask you who would win in a fight. Technically you, because he's dead, for sure. We know that. But even back in the day, Rough Riders, I don't know. I think I still give you the edge. What is the book about, In the Arena?
Well, Teddy Roosevelt's a tough dude, obviously. Medal of Honor recipient. I wouldn't want to tangle with that guy. The book, though, is not about Teddy Roosevelt. And as a conservative yourself, you know, we are very wary about where he descended into as the founder of the Progressive Party and leader of his Bull Moose candidate, gave us the disaster that was Woodrow Wilson. So the book is not about Roosevelt, and I come at him with clear eyes. It is about a speech that he gave in 1910, after his Republican presidency and before his descent into progressivism, the quote, you know it, you probably know it, the man, it's not the critic who counts, it's the man who is actually in the arena. And I carried that quote with me in Iraq and Afghanistan and Guantanamo Bay. It motivated me. Then I read the entire speech, and the entire speech is called Citizenship in a Republic. And it is I feel like a perfect roadmap for what America needs today. It was kind of non-PC before there even was PC. And it calls for two basic tenets, which are the tenets of the book: good citizenship, gritty, tough citizenship, what it requires to keep a republic great are good average citizens. And then ultimately, American leadership. And Roosevelt was a big believer in American power and American strength. And you know, right now, there's a big debate going on about America's role in the world. And I use examples from Iraq and Afghanistan and elsewhere to very much indict the Obama foreign policy, what I call a coexist foreign policy, and hold up why, if the 21st century is not an American century, it will not be a free century. So the book is not about Roosevelt. It's not about me. It's about making America, reinvigorating it, and making sure it's strong and free in the 21st century.
She's going to make sure you did good. It's about making America great again, but has nothing to do with Donald Trump.
That's where I was going.
So wait, on the front cover here, you've got a
You've got a quote from Mark Levin. Pete Hegseth lays out a citizen-led roadmap for forging. Everyone listening knows who Mark Levin is. Pete Hegseth lays out a citizen-led roadmap for forging another American century. If you would, Pete, walk us through this citizen-led roadmap, sir.
Yeah, the roadmap like that starts with citizens themselves, and that's what I love about what Roosevelt lays out. He talks about efficiency being the number one word of a citizen, and when I think of efficiency, I think of light bulbs and starting pitchers. What he means is, who are you, and do you live up to your own standard? Do you live up to being maximizing yourself? And that includes earning a living, working hard, providing for your family. That's a willingness to fight, you know, staying fit, being willing to fight for the things you believe in, both physically, maybe with a rifle, but also in the spheres of influence you have. Do you raise a large patriotic family? Roosevelt talks a lot about demographics. A lot of people don't want to talk about it, but look at Western Europe today, and the most popular name in London, as I know your listeners know, of newborn boys in London is Muhammad, and that's because demographics are very powerful. Roosevelt talks about that. And then finally, he talks about character, faith, character that really support are the indispensable supports of free people. Self-governance requires self-discipline. And so Roosevelt, before talking about voting and protesting and all the things we think of today when we think of citizens and a republic, he says, who are you and what do you believe? Are you active in your spheres of influence, and do you fight to advance the American experiment? And that's what The Arena is. The book is called In the Arena. It's not your arena or my arena. It's the arena of the American experiment. Are you involved in whatever capacity you can to fight for it? Do you watchdog the curriculum at your local school so it's not poisoned by progressives and leftists? Do you know who's on your school board and what they're imposing on you? Are you involved in your local elections, national elections? Are you involved in civic groups, civic organizations, church groups, things that feed and foster the things that have always been the indispensable supports of America? That's what we need to be investing in and fighting for, and everyone can do it. You don't have to be on the radio. You don't have to carry a rifle. You can do it with the people you know and influence, and it starts with yourself.
You know, one thing that I think is a fair question to ask now, in a way that perhaps even in recent years you would have gotten very different answers, or I think people would have looked at you quizzically like, well, of course I have the answer to that. That's, what does citizenship even mean in this country? You have an administration which is hoping to be, by the Democrats are hoping will be followed by another administration that believes that citizenship is something that, well, it can't really be legally defined, because if you come here legally or illegally, it should all be the same. And anybody who wants to be here, I mean, they're effectively de facto open borders advocates in a sense, which means that they're advocates of giving citizenship to anyone who wants to be here without respecting the law of the land, without having any sense of a reciprocal obligation here. Right. It's like the state's obligation to you and your obligations back to the state. You know, both of us come from a generation, you serve in the military, I serve from the CIA, where we've seen in a post 9/11 era, I think, a reinvigoration of citizenship. And I know it's something, when I was reading your book, I know it's something that you talk about. But I also feel like from a legal and a cultural perspective, citizenship is becoming a more amorphous thing, because the left is turning it into that. And I think they're doing so purposefully.
Amen. You landed on the central premise of the book. You've clearly read it. You get an A in the course here, Buck. Thank you for that. No, it is the left has a full out assault on what citizenship means, on what sovereignty means, on, frankly, the nation state. And that's where threats like Islamism and globalism and communism in the Chinese form, they're all the same. They want to break down the traditional and conventional nation state, which is ultimately a bedrock of the West, where America has a lot of influence and continues to. Our sovereignty is critical. What Roosevelt wrote about in his speech, and I love, he talks about citizens of the world. And that's what we're raising right now. And you've seen the bumper stickers, you know, no human being can be illegal. This whole idea that we should break down all borders and all allegiances. He warns against citizens of the world, who he calls inherently bad citizens of whatever country they live in. They're more concerned about humanity in this abject sense, in an abstract sense, than they are about being involved in their communities. And our job is to fight back on that premise. The problem is, even on the world stage, we're led right now by the first president who is himself a citizen of the world and has advanced those ideologies and viewpoints. And you see the reaction to someone like Donald Trump and other and conservatives who are talking about borders and talking about America and talking about why America is exceptional. I mean, the book makes a full-throated case for American exceptionalism, something you understand. This network understands, properly understood, that America is a special place and an incubator of freedom like nowhere else in the world, and therefore exceptional. But if you don't don't fight for it here and here and abroad, then it can be given away. History is never over. And right now the left is striking at the heart of it by trying to redefine citizenship. And so in a good point, a fundamental point of this book is to reestablish that definition and remind – this book's meant to inspire. It's a call to action. It's meant to motivate. I want to get people – remind them who we are, to be unapologetic about it, and to get out there. Because as you said, there's threats everywhere, and one of them is at the very idea of citizenship and sovereignty.
Now, you know, given where things are right now, you mentioned the election, so you opened that door, so we're going to walk through it for a second. Side note, everybody, In the Arena, Pete Hegseth, that is the book. Buy it irrespective of whatever his sense of the election is right now, because it's about citizenship and patriotism and not voting for one guy or the other. Let's get that out there right now. Passions are running a little high right now, Pete, given what happened last night. But I do think that there is an increasing sense among many who are on the right, many who tend towards patriotism, who tend towards reverence for the founding and the Constitution, that they want to withdraw, that whether they're Trump voters or anti-Trump voters, they feel like we're losing the culture war. It's all a waste. D.C.'s corrupt. I've got my own stuff to tend to. I don't want to waste my time with this. I mean, I think you and I both would have to agree that that's a widespread enough sentiment that it's worrying. What would you say to somebody who has those very feelings right now in light of you writing a book that essentially says, no, no, we have to rally? Why should they rally?
Because every generation of Americans have rallied, because previous generations in darker days even than this have decided it was worth fighting for. You know the Reagan quote? A lot of your listeners will, you know, freedom is never more than one generation away from extinction. You don't pass it to your kids in the bloodstream. You need to fight for it, lest we live in a country someday where we have to tell our grandkids what it was like to once, when men and women once lived free. It is every day, every generation must contribute, and is demoralized or happy or triumphant or whatever listeners are by this cycle. What the left wants, what the status quo wants, what those who want to fundamentally transform America want, they want us to quit. They want us to say it's just too hard. I've failed. I failed again. Then I failed another time. I'm done. I'm out. I'm going insular inside my shell. They are counting on that. And I saw that from my work at trying to reform the Department of Veterans Affairs. They want us to stop. They will attack you personally. They will attack you privately. They will attack you physically. And they want to intimidate you. And I'm trying to remind our patriots, our citizens in this country who maybe loved one candidate or another. This book certainly, in fact, this book makes the case. It's not about candidates. It's not about our leaders. If we were a dictatorship, then a great ruler would matter. In fact, the central premise of Roosevelt's speech is you can't have a great republic without good citizenship. The good citizens are the key. And so we are the answer. We are the response. And how we respond is going to matter in these dark and difficult days. So this book, if you're down and out and you're looking for a reason to remember why the fight is worth it, I would encourage you to pick up the book, because that is the point of the book, to keep people motivated.
All right, Pete, we've only got about a minute before we've got to close out here, but we got into politics just a little bit there for a second. Let me ask you, what are the chances in your mind right now that Hillary Clinton ends up winning against Donald Trump in the fall, based on everything we see right now? I know this is a total departure, but I'm just taking an early poll from everyone that I know and respect in the business. What do you think?
Better than 50%, but not inevitable. Let's put it that way. It is better than 50%, no doubt. This idea that Trump's going to win California or win Florida, where the numbers are just inherently stacked against him. He has so many challenges in front of him, including true conservative, constitutional conservatives, whatever you want to call them, who don't trust any manifestation he's going to create and are inclined, you know, the establishment types are going to support Hillary Clinton, which no one should do or can do as a conservative. But the temptation is that they might stay home. And you know, right now, we'll see.
All right, everybody, you heard it from the man himself, Pete Hegseth, author of In the Arena, Good Citizens, A Great Republic, and How One Speech Can Reinvigorate America. It is out in bookstores now. You can get it on Amazon. Captain Pete Hegseth, always a pleasure, my friend. Thank you for stopping by.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
All right, team, back in a few.
The Buck Sexton Show on the Blaze Radio Network.
You're listening to the Buck Sexton Show.
All right, team, the lines are lit up. Let's take a call from Holly in Pennsylvania. Holly, you're on the Buck Sexton Show. Welcome.
Hi. This is only the second time I called you. I'm so glad I had something to say to call back. But I just read that Kasich is going to suspend his campaign today. And it just made me livid so that I have to express myself.
We talked about this at the beginning of the show. Why does it make you livid? He has absolutely no chance of being the president.
Oh, okay. I didn't know you talked about it at the beginning of the show. I'm sorry, I'm taking care of a lot.
I'm not laughing about that. I'm laughing about Kasich just because, I mean,
it's because he's suspending it the day after Ted Cruz suspended his.
Ah, okay. Holly, let me let you make your case. I didn't mean to cut you off there. Go ahead. So why are you upset?
Because it makes me think that he was remaining in the race to take potential votes away from Ted Cruz. You know, if he wasn't in, Ted Cruz could have gotten, or probably would have gotten, many of his votes instead of Donald Trump.
I would have to say...
very suspicious looking.
I would have to say that given the reality of the Ted Cruz Kasich coalition, which didn't last very long, it would seem to me hard. Go ahead.
I just feel like that was a smokescreen.
So you're not buying that was for real. You thought, but why would Ted Cruz go along with that then? You think Kasich is that dishonest that he was kind of like, yeah, I'll be your friend, Ted Cruz? I mean, mathematically,
yes,
where would Ted Cruz have won? That you're aware, and I don't mean to put you in the spot, Holly, because I can't think of one off the top of my head. So I'm not trying to ask you a question that I can't even answer myself. But where would Cruz have won if it weren't for Kasich?
Well, he wouldn't. You're right. It was just not just in Indiana though, but I mean for the number of states that Kasich's remained in, that it was obvious, you know, he wasn't going to get anywhere with it. Along the way, there could have been so many more votes that maybe Ted Cruz would have had enough delegates at the end to have it all go to the convention.
I mean, but how many delegates is... Hold on, let me see. Delegates, John Kasich. I'll give you the final. I had this up at the beginning of the show.
But
I'm pulling up the numbers. He had 153 delegates. So as of May 4th, Trump had 1,047. Cruz had 565. Kasich had 153. So if you added every single delegate, now granted, it's some of the rules are a little funky, and you know you need to get to a certain threshold. You get all the delegates in some places, but I mean, at first glance, I've got to tell you, I don't think it would have made any. I'm going to be honest with you, it wouldn't have made any difference to Cruz whether Kasich stayed in or not. I think that the rest of the cast of thousands that stayed in for a long time, I said that earlier in the show as well. I think that did matter.
I agree too.
If we're going to. Okay, well, fair enough. But look, Holly, I appreciate you calling in, and thank you very much.
Yes, thanks. Bye.
All right. And hey, anytime. All kinds of ideas welcome here. Oh, team, we're very fortunate to be joined now by our special guest, Andrea Tenteros. You know her from Fox News, where she is a host. She's on many of the shows over there. Andrea Tenteros has a new book out, which you should all check out, called Tied Up in Knots, How Getting What We Wanted Made Women Miserable. I want to hear about this. Andrea, thank you for giving us some time.
Hi, Buck. It's great to be with you again. I love doing your show, so thank you.
Thank you so much. So please tell us about this book a bit. It sounds at first glance, I should say, when you're reading over the cover and looking into it, that this is sort of an anti-feminist explanation of modern actual feminism. But you tell me. You're the author.
Yeah. Well, this isn't a book to thrash feminists, Buck. I mean, I think so many conservative women have already, you know, they've already written those books and we've read them. This is sort of a modern day men are from Mars, women are from Venus, but from a conservative perspective. And what I do is I say, look, feminism's been great. I couldn't do what I do without feminism and all the opportunities that it's afforded me, but it's made some key mistakes. And those mistakes have led women to be pretty miserable and pretty stressed out. And it's affected men too. Because women love men, and most women want a committed relationship with a man. So if we're not happy, how is that affecting our partners? And by that I mean, you know, the feminists, Gloria Steinem, Betty Friedan, who wrote the Feminine Mystique, they told women, they perpetuated this myth that women didn't need men, So we can do everything on our own. We can open the door for ourselves and pay our own bills and don't pick up the check. I got it. So women are trying to do everything themselves. And then they also told us, when we do it, to act like men, to espouse how they do business, how they date, how they act. You know, we were encouraged to shirk our natural feminine desires like femininity, motherhood, like Hillary Clinton said, I'm not going to stay home and bake cookies. We were told to almost be what I call like a lady bro and be more masculine and covet the things that the men had, the big careers, the corner offices. And we did it not just at the expense of men, but we did it while we discarded all the things that made being a woman great, which are being able to have kids and a family and feel feminine. So whenever women are acting contrary or any human being to what they naturally want and desire, they're going to be pretty unhappy. So look what it's wrought. Women today are more stressed out than ever. They're on antidepressants. They're complaining. There's mommy wars. Single women can't find good men to marry or to date because of the rise of the hookup culture. And men, I mean, Buck, I know you know all about this. The men who say that they're demeaned, the wussification of America. I mean, the American dad is always the doofus in commercials, and American men are feeling pretty dejected right now. So the book really looks at both the perspective of women and men, and it uses some liberal language from figures in our pop culture, which are pretty non-traditional messengers with very traditional messages. So it's very different than any other book.
Now, what are some of the ways that you would offer to women reading this, particularly young women who are still about to make these choices, although I'm sure that the wisdom contained in these pages also applies to people at various stages, and and it'll apply to how they interact with their children. And it sounds like this is really for both sexes, right? You're saying it's choices that women are making, but obviously choices women make affect men. But if you were sitting before, and we have a healthy contingent, a strong contingent of what we call our Team Buck Campus or Team Buck Millennials listening in, young women in their 20s, what are some of the things that you would pass on to them that you kind of wish somebody, given what you know about having a career, about establishing yourself as a very successful media personality, but you've learned a lot in that process, what do you wish somebody had told you when you were a freshman in college?
You know, Buck, that's why you get paid the big bucks, to ask the good questions. I wish somebody gave me this book when I was in my 20s, because I write it from the perspective of exactly where I am in my life. So as a woman who had every benefit of feminism, I was a direct beneficiary. I've had a great career. I love my job and my career, and I thank the feminists for that. However, I made a lot of mistakes, but I tried every directive they told me to try. I've played like a man. I've manned up, but I've also played like a girl. I've cried at work. I've not cried at work. I've tried to be more masculine and pick up the check, and I've tried to sit back and be more vulnerable and be the lady. So in the book, I tell girls what works and what doesn't work, and I caution them on believing wholeheartedly the tenets of feminism, which is you don't need a man, that you should put off motherhood and kids without preparing. I mean, I think women should be able to chart their own course, but girls graduating from college now have lower self-esteem than ever. They're pressured to, you know, sex and put naked pictures, you know, out there to guys and sign up and just shirk monogamy. Well, women are wired differently than men. You know, feminism wanted women to be equal, but equal doesn't mean the same. And any woman will tell you that men and women are different. I mean, just watch The Bachelor. Women meet a man for 60 seconds and they start having a nervous breakdown if he doesn't pick them. Guys are very different from that. And so when women are encouraged by feminists, Helen Gurley Brown is one, the editor, a former editor of Cosmo. She was one of the early feminists that told women, listen, don't tear down the patriarchy like Gloria Steinem. Use your sexuality to navigate it. And women have shirked monogamy, which goes against our wiring. Women don't want to be all over the place acting like men. You know, the Sex and the City character Samantha, most women aren't like that. And men don't really want women, maybe for one night, but long term, who act like that.
I feel like there's a.
And yeah,
I was going to say that there's the experiment that was played out with millions and millions. I mean, you couldn't really devise a better scientific experiment in some ways to see this difference between men and women than when there was that Ashley Madison hack and everybody figured out, okay, there are 10 million guys who are looking to
basically hook up on the sly. And when they actually, when they whittled it down to real profiles of real women, it was in the thousands. It was almost none. And I think that was finally, people had its recognition of, wow, there really is a difference here. Women don't want what guys want when it comes to this stuff. And especially these guys who are on there trying to do what they're doing. But the numbers spoke for themselves. It was like 10 million to 10,000.
Yeah. No, you're absolutely right. I mean, And there's a lot that I get into the book because no one really talks about how we got here. So everyone will, you know, read a survey that says the female breadwinner boom in the Wall Street Journal about how women are making more than men. And everyone will read and go, oh, okay, that's interesting, and move on with their lives. But
now,
let's flesh that out. What does that mean? Like, what does that mean? So I look in the book and I say, okay, with women making more now than men in a lot of different industries, in the middle of an equal pay debate, in the middle of a gender war where men are feeling like they're on strike and they're emasculated by women and by society, and with women feeling really powerful, and you have Steve Harvey, again, so this is an example of a non-traditional messenger espousing a traditional message. Steve Harvey says, ladies, we need to help you. We can't, if you keep telling us you don't need us, we can't help you. We feel good when we can do things for you. We don't know where we fit in if you keep telling us you've got the bill, you've got a security system, you've got a job. We need to be able to help you. And so I think now you see women going, okay, I actually need a little backup. Jenny McCarthy yesterday, I talked to her on her radio show, and she said, oh my God, I had the same moment as you did. I'm a strong woman, and you know, I can't be intimidated. She goes, I was picking up the check. I was doing everything myself. And I was so unhappy, and it was causing me all the strife in my relationships. And then I just said, you know what? I want to be a wife. I want to surrender. I want to take Donnie Wahlberg's last name. And she's happier than ever, which is exactly the position I'm in. I would tell girls, like, listen, don't try and do it all yourself. You can't have it all if you're doing it all alone. It's okay if you're young to admit that you want marriage and you want kids. Because now women were never told that having all these great careers would affect their fertility. That's why women are panicking, freezing their eggs. I mean, there have been so many effects of feminism that affect women and that affect men. I mean, you talked about Ashley Madison. So, Buck, why are people cheating? I mean, we read the story about Ashley Madison, which I talk about in my book, but why? Why are men turning to pornography? Or why are men cheating? I've done a lot of research. It shows that men oftentimes cheat because they're not feeling that they get the attention at home. Well, why aren't they getting the attention at home? If you look at the verbatims from the men, they say, well, my wife's busy working. She has the pressures of being a high-powered feminist, you know, and she doesn't have enough time to do her job and come home and, you know, do the housework and help me with the kids. And so men are looking for attention elsewhere. I mean,
the number one thing I've always read is that men who cheat feel underappreciated. It's not because there's someone else who's so sexy or so great or whatever. The number one reason in all the surveys I've read is men feel underappreciated by their significant other or spouse.
You know, women are encouraged not to be nice to their men or kind. You know, Glamour magazine published a column last year that they redacted, and all it said, Buck, was 10 ways to make your man happy. And we talked about it on Outnumbered, and, you know, I was sitting there on the couch, and I said, well, these aren't terrible suggestions. Bring him a beer, make him a sandwich if he's hungry, ask him about his friends and his childhood, and be nice to his friends. I thought, well, isn't this just common sense? And feminists, they just impugned me, liberal women. They said, Andrea Senteros wants to send women back to the 1950s and put them in the kitchen. I thought, well, I couldn't be further from that kind of woman. Definitely not doing that. But at the same time, if we took that title and put 10 ways to make your woman happy, women would be applauding. Or 10 ways to make your mom happy for Mother's Day, we'd be celebrating it and saying, oh, great ideas. Why, when it's 10 ways to make your men happy, do women say, this is really misogynistic?
The answers to that question will be found in Andrea's book. Andrea, we've run up out of time here, but everybody, the book is Tied Up in Knots. The author, Andrea Tantaros, you know her from Fox. You should check out her book, Tied Up in Knots, How Getting What We Wanted Made Women Miserable, available now in fine bookstores everywhere and on Amazon. Andrea, thank you so much for calling in today.
My pleasure, Buck. Thank you.
Great talking to you. Team, we'll be right back.
The Buck Sexton Show.
Discover more at theblaze.com/radio.
The Blaze Radio Network. Buck Sexton, The Blaze Radio Network.
Well, team, as always, I appreciate your time, and I would ask you the small favor of downloading today's show. You can go to theblaze.com/Buck Sexton. Please share it with a friend. And you're sitting there, you're like, hey, I got an idea. Instead of sending some random meme off that, you know, from someone you don't know, you could send them a link to the Buck Sexton Show download, and they could download it, and they can check for themselves whether they want to be a part of the Freedom Hut. This would be a super awesome, amazing thing for you to do, and it helps me out, and I like it. So please do that for me, if you would not mind. I had a lot of guests on today, which is fun. Tomorrow, my voice is also getting stronger, which makes me happy, so I'll be able to sort of do, I think, of course, they're just broke. I think I'll be able to do almost an entirely normal show tomorrow. Commie Bear is in the guest lineup. I need to have my voice back to do. I mean, he needs to have his voice back because he's been drinking too much recently. We have a phenomenal guest lineup tomorrow. Hopefully nobody has to bail last minute because of some obligation or anything like that. But otherwise, you're going to love the squad I've got prepared for tomorrow. And in the meantime, team, please go to facebook.com/BuckSexton. You can read my CNN.com piece, which I've posted there. Until tomorrow in the hut, my friends, shields high.
You're listening to Buck Sexton on the Blaze Radio Network.